Well, several years ago, when Mabel and Roe were younger, one of the major highlights of the feast days was getting toys. They went through a princess phase. They not only had to, of course, wear the princess dresses, but they had to have all the toys that we could find related to princesses. They went through a calico critter phase. And if you aren't really close to the toy game now, those are basically these little tiny animals. They're like maybe an inch and a half. And they have these really tiny, basically accoutrements that go with the toy itself. So like you'll have like a little desk, and you'll have like this little tiny fork and this little tiny tomato. You end up losing all of them, but they're fun for quite a while. Macy's really going into that phase right now, except she's not she doesn't have the coordination to do it. So she'll start setting up like the three-course meal and then just knock it all over, is normally how it goes at our house. But going back to this is when Mabel and Roe were younger. They went through a little My Little Ponies phase. They were these little maybe you've heard of those. And then also there was a Sesame Street character toy phase that they went through as well. And in that time, Elmo was their particular favorite. But with all of this, Mabel and Roe would make these lists of desired toys during the feast days. And I know we're past this, but this is the best introduction I could come up with for this topic. So stick with me here. So they would go on Amazon, look up the price, and then of course they would want to negotiate on why their budget should be increased. And so that was a fun part of the process, at least on my end. But one of the years, while they were picking out toys, they even adapted a hymn to accommodate their hopes and dreams. And Jeff did me a solid because we just sang it. It was hymn 153, There's Joy in My Heart. Now, Mabel and Roe's version went something like this, and I have a pretty vivid memory of Mabel blasting this full blast in our living room with her voice. It was... And I'm not going to sing it because y'all hear me when I song lead, but I'll just say it. There are toys in my heart, knowing Christ will come again. There are toys in my heart, knowing Christ will come again. For 1,000 years, the toys will never end. There will be toys in the world when he comes. So toy acquisition was clearly in the heart of my children during the holiday season. But my question today is, what is in your heart? Now, I'm not talking about managing the day-to-day activities of our jobs, you know, working through school deadlines, the continual never-ending laundry, the meal prep, the cleanup, lawn maintenance. Thankfully, that's coming to a close. But I want you to think deeper. Deeper than the day-to-day hustle of managing a work team or trying to manage conflicting timelines and various projects. Deeper than keeping track of all your kids' schedules, their homework, maybe college. But when your phone is turned off and you're sitting by yourself, quietly looking out at nature, when you have a quiet moment, when you're just looking at the ceiling of your bed, what is on your heart? I find it to be a hard question. If you're like me, you spend a significant amount of time juggling physical obligations. My job's always asking for more. I've got another toddler again. It's a never-ending task trying to keep up with her. The house is always a wreck. There's property maintenance. Older kids need attention. I don't want to neglect them. There's church obligations, like writing a split sermon. There's church activities. You're trying to fit in. And then I have a very tiny social life as well. And those are all important. But I try to bear my worldly responsibilities with grace and endurance, but I fall short. So when the noise turns off and I just sit in silence, I want you to really think about what is in your heart. And I'm going to pause just a second and let you think about that. What is in your heart? I'd like to turn over to 1 Samuel 13, if you'll go over there with me. 1 Samuel 13, and we're actually going to start in verse 13. Here Samuel's going to be talking to Saul, and Saul had just offered burnt offerings, which was not his place to do. So go to 1 Samuel 13. Try to get over there myself. We're going to pick it up in verse 13. And Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever." And continuing in verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have kept what the Lord commanded you." So the Lord sought a man after his own heart. I'm sure most of you are aware that was David. But it's really interesting that it's a man after God's own heart. You know, if you think about other patriarchs, they aren't really called out for this attribute, even if they have God's Holy Spirit. Abraham's called a friend of God. Moses spoke to the Lord face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. Other men are called beloved, apostles, servants, witnesses, friends. But David had this unique characteristic, a man after God's own heart. I'd like to turn to 1 Samuel 16, if you would, with me next. 1 Samuel 16. I'm going to read verse 1 over here. For Samuel 16, verse 1. And it states, "Now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I've rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go, and I'm sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons." Now let's drop down to verse 4, if you would. Verse 4. "So Samuel did what the Lord said and went to Bethlehem, and the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, do you come peaceably? And he said, peaceably I have come to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons, and he divided them to the sacrifice." Verse 6. "So it was when they came, they looked at Eliab, and he said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him, for the Lord does not see as man sees. For a man sees his outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." I think verse 7 is sort of interesting. You may not think that you judge by outward appearance, but it's in your human nature to do so. So man generally has a bias. I think some of us would acknowledge this some, and maybe with some of God's Holy Spirit we don't do it as much. But man's general bias is to judge based on what he sees. And if you look up the Hebrew word for outward appearance, it's literally to his eyes. So we're judging by our eyes. So it's talking about judging people from the outside, from physical looks, from height, from build, maybe clothing, posture, or even age. But man looks on external traits, but the Lord looks at the heart. The Hebrew word for at the heart is the inner person, their thoughts, emotions, will, or even motives. Now let's drop down to verse 11, if you would, here in 1 Samuel 16. "And Samuel said to Jesse, are all the young men here? Then he said, there remains yet the youngest, and that he is keeping sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, bring him, send him and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes. So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking. And the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is the one. Then Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward." And we're going to stop right there. But the point is, out of any of the brothers that could have been chosen, David was anointed king because of his heart. So why exactly was David called a man after God's own heart? Have you ever really thought about it? And maybe a question for us today is, could you be called a man or woman after God's own heart? Well, for the rest of the split sermon, I'd like to explore three behaviors that David had that made him a man after God's own heart. I'd like to pick up one of those over in the book of Psalms, Psalm 40. It's going to be a book, Psalm of David, Psalm 40. I'm going to just read a single verse over here on this particular psalm, Psalm 40, verse 8. And it states, "I delight to do your will, O my God. and your law is within my heart. So what is one behavior that made David a man after God's own heart? Point one is delighting to do God's will. Point one, delighting to do God's will. Go over to Psalm 51, just a few pages over. Tried to structure my scripture sort of close together today, so hopefully it'll make it a little easier for y'all. But if we go to Psalm 51, we're going to read verses 10 and 11 over here. Now, this particular psalm was written after the sin that was committed with Bathsheba. We're going to notice Psalm 50, chapter 51, verse 10 and 11. And it states, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me." Many of you know that I had a brother-in-law, Cody Kitts. He died a few years ago from a tree removal accident. But one of the memories I have of him is we had a conversation about praying, and he told me he would reference this area and ask God for a clean heart. And there's just a number of different things I remember about him, but that was one that just sort of stuck with me. What about your heart? Have you ever prayed to have a clean heart? Maybe when you went through baptism? Maybe around Passover? Have you prayed for a clean heart? Or is your heart set on the physical day-to-day activities? I'd like to go over to Psalm 119. Psalm 119. I'm going to read verses 10 and 11 over here. Psalm 119. Starting in verse 10. And it states, "With my whole heart I have sought you. Oh, let me not wander from your commandments. Your word I have hidden in my heart, that I might not sin against you." If we make an effort to put God's commandments into our heart, it creates a defense against sin from multiplying, as it's sort of mentioned here in verse 11. Will we slip up? Of course. But when we put our whole heart into seeking God, sin isn't likely to multiply. Let's drop down to verse 33 here in Psalm 119. And it states, "Teach me, O Lord, the way of your statutes, and I will keep it to the end. Give me understanding, and I will keep your law. Indeed, I shall observe it with my whole heart. Make me walk in the path of my commandments, for I delight in them. Incline my heart to your testimonies, and not to covetousness. Now, although the author of Psalm 119 isn't explicitly called out, sort of at the beginning of the chapter, like some of the others, the authorship seems to suggest that David is a pretty strong possibility for writing this. And we see some similar themes of other psalms of actually David, so I thought it was applicable to put it in here. But what is in your heart? Does it delight in God's will? My family is paying for a number of streaming services now. We go through these phases, or I do. I hate having subscriptions. They're like the worst to me because you have this annuity going to a different company that's coming out of your pocket, and I'm cheap by nature, so I cycle through different apps, and so sometimes I'm like, oh, okay, I'll cut off certain apps and not have commercials, or I'll have more apps, and depending on feedback from particularly Mabel and Roe, I'll sort of accommodate that. However, we do have the Hulu app right now, which I know is sort of merged partially with Disney, but they tend to have this one commercial about Capital One. And it's been their catchphrase, I looked it up, since like 2001. You probably know what it is, and it says, "What's in your wallet," right? Capital One. Am I seeing a few nods, maybe? All right, if not, I'll just assume y'all are more holy than I am and don't watch TV or something. But anyway, for a lot of Americans, they probably know that. So it's, "What's in your wallet?" But as Christians, Ro had a great idea, and she's like, "What's in your heart?" And I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting. So I decided to put that in here. She said that last night at dinner. So I do listen, Ro. But if you've noticed on the Capital One commercials, they they often have people do it with different accents and stuff, so it stays sort of imprinted in your brain. So if you need a what's in your heart, or whatever you need, whatever accent you need to have that imprinted into your head, maybe when you see that phrase next time, you'll think back on this message on what's in your heart. But let's now explore another behavior of this man after God's own heart. So point two today is showing deep faith in God. Showing deep faith in God. I'd like to turn back to 1 Samuel 17. It's a pretty familiar story in totality, but with David and Goliath, but we're going to cover a few verses here on David's mindset, because I think it's a little bit interesting if you sort of zoom in on certain aspects of it. So let's go to 1 Samuel 17. We're going to go starting in verse 32. And it states, "Then David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail because of him,'" talking about Goliath, "'your servant will go and fight with this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth.'" Verse 34, "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant used to keep his father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be one of them, seeing he has defiled the armies of the living God.' Moreover, David said, 'The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'Go, and the Lord be with you.'" An interesting sort of piece of this is notice how David credited God for the victory even before he went up to face Goliath. I mean, if you think about your own life, how often have you thought that, well, God's going to deliver me before a tense situation? Maybe you've thought it. Do you choose to have a steadfast faith like David to even declare it before the heat's turned up? Do you have a heart like David? And do you think your faith, not just to have the faith, but to declare it, to say it? And if you really think about it, like, David wasn't sitting in front of a mirror giving himself a pep talk like, "I can do this. God's going to help me out." He's declaring it to the highest authority in his day. He's saying it to the king himself, that he's going to go and God will deliver him. And if you really think about what kind of faith that is, to not only declare it before, but to call it out and have the utmost confidence that God will deliver you, it's pretty astonishing. But I'd like to turn over to another unnerving situation with David over in 1 Samuel 24. I'm going to start in verse 6 over here. Some of this context, Saul had taken about 3,000 chosen men from Israel to seek out David and his men in the rocks. So we're going to start here in, actually we're going to start in verse 3, not verse 6. So 1 Samuel 24, verse 3. "And he said, 'So he, Saul, came to the sheepfolds by the road, and where there was a cave, and Saul went in to attend to his needs, and David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave.'" Verse 4. "Then the men of David said to him," talking about David, "'This is the day which the Lord said to you, Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, and that you must do to him as it seems good to you.'" Now, if you put yourself in David's situation here, this is probably pretty unsettling. So David clearly was questioning what his men were telling him. Obviously, he knew he was going to take the throne. Was this the right timing? Should he strike Saul to take the throne? Had God himself actually created the circumstances that would cause him to want to act here? He wasn't explicitly told to do that, but you know, if you think about being in the situation, you might have thought the same thing. But let's continue here in the last part of verse 4. "And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now it happened afterward that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe." So here we see that David did end up going into the cave and clearly was tempted to act in some kind of way. Was he trying to send a message by just cutting off a corner of Saul's robe? And was that message supposed to convey restraint by David's part against Saul, showing that David could have killed him? Well, that would have been my assumption last week, but I dug a little bit more into it, and I actually have a different opinion now. So it could be taken in a slightly different way. You see, the robe mentioned here isn't just any garment. If you look up the Hebrew word distinctive, the Hebrew word here for his robe, it's an outer robe worn by persons of rank, especially kings or priests. So maybe this wasn't really a message about restraint. It could have been symbolic of a rebellion against royal authority. And the fact that David's conscience troubled him immediately after probably leads a little bit more evidence to the latter theory, but I can't really say 100%. But notice David's focus on the authority from the Lord, mentioning it twice here in verse 6. Let's continue in 1 Samuel 24, verse 6. "And he said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, and to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord.'" So David restrained his servants with his words and did not allow them to rise against Saul, and Saul got up from the cave and went on his way. Now, if you think about it, many people in David's place would have killed Saul and tried to immediately ascend to the throne. But David chose to have deep faith in God instead and operate on God's timetable. Let's look a couple of chapters over in 1 Samuel 26. It's right in the same vein. It's the same song and story almost, just a couple chapters over. So here, again, Saul's looking for David with these 3,000 chosen men of Israel. And David had sent spies to confirm that David and his that Saul and his group is camping, so it was confirmed. So we'll pick it up here in 1 Samuel 26 and verse 6. And it states, "Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, the brother of Joab, saying, 'Who will go with me to Saul in the camp?' And Abishai said, 'I will go with you.' So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp, with his spear struck in the ground by his head, and Abner and the people lay all around him. Then Abishai said to David, 'God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please, let me strike him at once with the spear right on the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time.'" Although this time it's in Saul's camp versus a cave, David was once again confronted with this opportunity to kill Saul. But this time, he didn't even have to do it himself. I mean, it was easier. All he had to do was give the word or give the signal. And Abishai will go ahead and do it. But notice his focus on God's appointment to kingship in this response, and that's what makes me think probably in chapter 24 that we read a little bit earlier, it was the latter of the two theories that I presented. But let's notice here in verse 9. "But David said to Abishai, 'Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?' Verse 10, David said furthermore, 'As the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. And the Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but please take now the spear and the jug of water, which by his head, and let him go.'" So David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away, and no man saw or knew it or awoke, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. So David, in this instance, takes his spear and jug of water rather than a piece of his robe. But there's no mention of remorse after he does it. And in fact, so he's really not undercutting the royal authority by God. And in fact, he actually gives the king's spear back in verse 22. So David, in this instance, chose to be steadfast in faith, sparing Saul yet again. Well, let's now go to the third behavior of David that made him a man after God's own heart. This will be the final one we'll cover for the first split sermon. Point 3, is love for God's commandments. Love for God's commandments. We'll go back to Psalm 119. Again, the third point on the third behavior of why David was called a man after God's own heart. He loved love for God's commandments. So if we go to Psalm 119, I'm going to start in verse 46 this time. Psalm 119, verse 46. And it states, I will speak of your testimonies also before kings, and I will not be ashamed. And I will delight myself in your commandments, which I love. My hands also I will lift up to your commandments, which I love. And I will meditate on your statutes. Learning to love God's commandments takes a long time. You know, if you think about some of God's statutes, some of them are basic. You know, you get a Sabbath rest. Some people could view that as a negative on not being able to work on your earthly pursuits. But one example I was thinking of is tithing. So, you know, if you come into the church, it might hurt at first. It could be shocking. And then you keep studying and realize, oh, man, there's a couple different tithes we have to keep. This is even way harder than I thought it was. But over time, you learn to appreciate the process, and you can ultimately learn to love it. And if you think about it, God really doesn't need our money. I mean, God could choose to fund the work a different way. He could call a few just very rich donors or billionaire, take care of all God's people along the way. But I've always found an example interesting in Matthew 17, and I can't remember a single time we've gone over this in church, and I was just going to mention it, but I sort of want to go over there because it's sort of an interesting little tidbits. There's occasionally in the Bible just something that sort of makes you scratch your head and wonder why Jesus did something a certain way, but I want to explore that just for a second. Let's go over to Matthew 17. I'll just give a little bit of the brief context surrounding this. So Peter's getting hassled by someone about a temple tax. And although Jesus points out that only strangers pay taxes, not sons, he tells Peter to do something sort of funny on the surface. So if you go over to Matthew 17, we're going to read verse 27. Matthew 17, verse 27. And he states, nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, and again he's talking to Peter here, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. And when you open up its mouth, you find a piece of money. And take that and give that to me, for me and you. And if you look in your center of reference column, if you have that, this piece of money was the exact temple tax that was supposed to be paid for both Peter and Jesus. Jesus could have just said to Peter, here's some money. I had this left over. You can just pay this temple tax. Jesus could have commanded one of the other disciples, like, hey, could you help a friend out? Could you go pay this for me? That'd be great. But instead, Jesus sends Peter to go to the sea, to cast a line, to bring up a fish, and then to put his hand in that slimy mouth, the slimy mouth of the fish, to pull out a piece of money. And it's a really just sort of interesting thing. If anyone has any other theories on why, I would love to hear it. I did a little research. I couldn't find anything right offhand. But, you know, if you think about the church, and we're building the new auditorium, obviously, you know, God could ask Jim Franks to cast a line and just find some sunken treasure. I mean, that would be more exciting, right, than tithing. I mean, an interesting way to fund some of the church projects. But God gave us commandments for a reason, so we learn in the process. It's the process of learning to becoming more like Him. But with obedience, we can learn to like and ultimately to love God's commandments. Let's go over to another Psalm of David over in Psalm 19. I'm going to read verses 7 to 10 over here. Psalm 19, verses 7 to 10. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul, and the testimony of the Lord is pure, is sure, making wise and the simple. The statute of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart, and the commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold. Yea, they are much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. So there's sort of a lot to unpack there, but what I put in my notes of sort of a takeaway is it's very simple. God's law equals perfect, sure, right, pure, true righteousness. So there's a ton of pack. You could probably even get a whole split sermon or sermon on that particular section, but it's of more worth than anything we could possibly find on this earth. So it mentions here gold, but I mean, you could plug in any precious metal or whatever you value on this earth. And it's also sweeter than any treat. You know, it's honey is mentioned here, but you could plug in any sweet treat. And with time and repetition, we can learn to love God's commandments, just like David. Well, today we've reviewed three behaviors of David, a man after God's own heart. Delighting to do God's will, showing deep faith in God, and exhibiting love for God's commandments. And there's part of Acts 13, verse 22, which sort of sums up the theme of this split sermon. And you don't need to turn there. I'm just going to read a very small subsection of it. But it's Acts 13, verse 22. And it states, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do my will. Are you someone like David who will do God's will? What's in your heart? Mabel and Roe used to have toys in their heart, knowing that Christ would come again. What do you find in yours? If you find something you don't like, you can be like David and ask God for a clean heart. What's in your heart?